All right, well, you all showed up on time. So we are going to honor your time and get the most out of our wonderful speaker this morning. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the kickoff adult ed for the 2022-23 program year here at Nassau Presbyterian Church. I am Thais Carter. I serve on the adult ed committee, and it is my great pleasure to welcome this morning Dr. Sanyu Majola. She is a professor of sociology and public affairs and the director of the Office of Population Research here at Princeton University. For those of you who have not already seen the announcement, our whole theme for the kickoff of adult ed this year is thinking about hearing from all corners of our community. We are so fortunate that as Nassau, we have access to the university and to the seminary, but also all of these really phenomenal partnerships that we've been able to cultivate over the years. And so our hope for this series is that you have the opportunity to hear from the people that we are so fortunate to have helping us kind of learn and challenge us and ask interesting questions and just discover more about the world that we live in and how God is moving in the world that we live in. So a little bit more about Sanyu before I kick things over to her. Her research examines how societies produce health and illness, and she is especially interested in how gender, race, ethnicity, aging, and the life course and socioeconomic status shape health outcomes. Her work primarily focuses on the HIV/AIDS pandemic as it unfolds in various settings such as Kenya, the United States, and South Africa. And her first book, Love, Money, and HIV, Becoming a Modern African Woman in the Age of AIDS, has won multiple awards, including the 2016 Distinguished Scholarly Book Award from the American Sociological Association. So we are very fortunate to have her in this corner of our community. And with that, Sanyu, take it away.
It's on now. Can you all hear me? I think so, yeah. Okay. Oh, sorry?
I think you gotta move it up.
Up? Okay. Yeah. There we go. Okay. I'm really grateful to the Nassau Presbyterian Church and to Thais Carter for the invitation and opportunity to share my work with you all. I came to Princeton in 2018, but the pandemic makes me feel like I just got here. So is it still not loud enough?
Sorry, I don't want to like be in the way, but I'm gonna do it this way.
Okay, I'll also talk louder. So I'm going to be presenting work from a large team project called HIV After 40. We've been working on since 2013. And our goal is to study the causes and consequences of the HIV epidemic among middle-aged and older adults who are often neglected. There's been a lot of focus on young people. And we're also trying to understand the complexities of aging in rural post-apartheid South Africa using the lens of the HIV pandemic. And as the COVID-19 pandemic has shown, disease has a way of shedding light on social dynamics or revealing what lies under the hood of society. And this is what I try and do in my work in general and in this project in particular. So in 2019, the United Nations AIDS report recorded 1.7 million new HIV infections and 770,000 AIDS-related deaths worldwide. And this is despite now, 40 years of extensive experience of AIDS deaths, widespread knowledge about prevention, including condom use, and expanded and free access to antiretroviral medication. So it's not because of ignorance, in other words. And a disproportionate burden of the infections and deaths, about 61% in sub-Saharan Africa. So beyond good luck, why do some people successfully adapt to change in the context of a life and death pandemic like HIV/AIDS while others don't? And the stakes are especially high. South Africa has the world's worst HIV epidemic. Almost 8 million people are living with HIV. This is about 20% of the adult population, so it's quite significant. And you'll also see a really rapid increase from the 90s, where it was about 1 million, to about 8 million today. So it's the world's largest HIV-positive population. And because it's an incurable disease, this number will only grow until there's a cure. So I want to give a bit of brief historical and political context for those who are less familiar with South Africa and its HIV epidemic. And so South Africa had a system of apartheid which created racial, gender, and geographic separation and entrenched black poverty and disenfranchisement. There were a series of legislative acts between 1913 and 1975, which forced the relocation of African populations to rural areas, which were called Bantustans or homelands, which had poor agricultural land and limited economic infrastructure. So, for example, in 1951, there was a Bantu Authorities Act, which relocated 70% of the African population to 13% of the land. And this was some of the worst agricultural land in the country. And so men were then coercively recruited to go and work in distant mines and farms where they lived in these all-male dormitories or hostels. And then they needed a pass to go back to visit their families once a year or every 18 months because they were denied citizenship. And so this apartheid-era labor system had consequences for black family life in South Africa. There was a forcible separation of families, which shaped then gender norms and expectations both around sexual partnering in the workplace as well as at home because of this long-term partner separation. And so it changed norms around having relationships outside of marriage. And this had consequences for the HIV epidemic to come. Now, the end of apartheid white minority rule, the election of Nelson Mandela, brought about a host of political, economic, and legal changes. So there was a new constitution which created racial, gender, and sexual equality, including rights and freedom for women, pushbacks against patriarchal customs like virginity testing, for example, and there was a new freedom for the media to talk publicly about sex and sexuality. But at the same time, and this is what made the transition particularly cruel, was the AIDS epidemic was also taking off. And so it was during this sort of early period of liberation when the rates started to rise. And there was little political attention paid. And unfortunately, the subsequent government under President Mbeki denied that HIV caused AIDS, and they used this to deny medication access to the population. And so there was a massive campaign, treatment action campaign, had to take the government to court to force them to give medication to people. So during this time, between 97 and 2010, about 2.7 million South Africans died of AIDS. Yeah, it was terrible. But thanks to activist efforts, South Africa now has the largest medication program in the world. But the economy has continued to falter from the 80s and 90s into the present, resulting in really high unemployment. Some rates are as high as 50% of young people don't have work jobs. And so this circular labor migration has continued, so leaving home for long periods of time to find work. In the area we study, about 60% of men migrate out for work to mines, farms, and cities. And so these sexual partnering patterns set in motion in apartheid with recurrent reunions and separations have continued. But the big difference is now they're continuing in the context of an HIV epidemic. So in terms of faith, about 80% of South Africans identify as Christian, and many attend African independent churches. And so faith was an important part of how people navigated the epidemic, and so I'll talk about how this showed up in our study. So every part of the country was affected by the epidemic. These are they used to at first test pregnant women in clinics, and so these rates are actually quite alarming. You can't see it, but the red is up 35%. So about a third of pregnant women testing positive, and then the orange is about 30 to 35%. So we were studying Mpumalanga province up here, had some of the worst HIV epidemic in the country. And so specifically, our study is based in Agincourt, in the Agincourt Health and Sociodemographic Surveillance System. It's near Kruger National Park. In fact, it's right next to Kruger National Park. That was land they were displaced from. And the study, the site covers over 90,000 people. And they've been followed since 1992. And so it's run by the University of Witwatersrand. And so the area, because it's a former apartheid area, still bears a legacy of poor employment, local services, and really high labor migration. And so this is perhaps the most alarming figure I'll show you today. And it shows you just how severe the epidemic is. And so as you'll see among, and this is age group, 15 to 19, 20 to 24, and so on, up to 80 to 85. And this is the proportion of people with HIV. So you'll see that by age 20 to 24, about a quarter of young women have HIV, about 10% of men. And you'll see that by the time they get to their late 30s, early 40s, about half of adults have HIV. But what is really striking and especially surprising is if you notice the rates are really high even up until the 70s. So about 30% of people in their 50s, about 20% people in their 60s, and about 10% of people in their 70s are living with HIV. And again, this is a group that hasn't been studied much. So medication was only available, as I mentioned, really late, so to 2004, and in local clinics in 2008. And so this suggests that we're not just looking at people who survived, but new infections. So in other words, not people who got it when they were young and aged, but people who got it when they were older adults. And so only about a third of people were on medication at the time of this survey. And people only live about six to 10 years without medication. And so this suggests that most people 50 and over got HIV after the age of 40. So really alarming high rates. And these high rates of HIV translated and low medication translated into a lot of death. There was really quite a lot of death in this area. To show you just how severe, life expectancy declined from 73 years for women to 59 years, and for men from 68 years to 53 years between 94 and 2004. So they've since rolled out more medication, so about two-thirds of the population now have medication, but you'll see the life expectancy rates haven't yet fully rebounded. So for women, it's only up to 64 years, and for men, 56 years. It's also important to note that most of the deaths were among middle-aged and older adults. And so we often, again, think about young people, but most people dying of AIDS in this area were middle-aged and older adults. And so when you think about adapting to change, it's really important to think about how middle-aged and older adults adapt to change, not just young adults. So let me briefly talk about how we're thinking about this before showing you what we found. So Africans have been trying to avoid HIV for the last 40 years. Right? That's how old the epidemic is. And several researchers have uncovered what Ann Swidler, a sociologist, calls strategies of action. Like what are the ways in which people try and avoid HIV? So there have been big campaigns which have focused on abstinence, being faithful, or condom use, which we call the ABC campaigns. But there have also been local techniques like social autopsies. And so people observe a partner to determine whether they should use a condom or not, and look at their behavior. Other people simply discount the risk. Like if they really want a child, they're just going to pretend that their partner is not positive. The other strategy I found in my own work is trust and love, a sort of a prophylactic strategy. So I'm going to trust you not to give me HIV. We won't test or use a condom. I'm just going to trust you because I love you. And then, of course, religion. And so not just abstinence or faithfulness, but also things like prayer. So people believe that God will heal or God will protect them so that we don't need to use a condom. And then also some churches were recommending a special kind of tea. So there were also dietary practices that the churches were recommending. But then there also, I think, the other side of this that we're thinking about is also people not taking action deliberately. So either ignoring risk, circumscribing it, saying it's only particular groups of people who are at risk, so I don't need to do anything, or postponing it. So for young people in particular, this is incompatible with trying to have a child. ABC is compatible with trying to have a child or find a partner. And so young people could sometimes postpone strategies of action. But there are special considerations for middle-aged and older adults when it comes to HIV prevention. What happens after childbearing, after divorce or widowhood? What happens as time passes over the 40 years? Have people change their strategies as they age? So this is what we're trying to understand. Aging, adapting to change is a core feature of the aging process. We may feel like ourselves are not aging, but our bodies are aging, and we're going through multiple historical periods with varying degrees of success, right? We can't stop the tides of time. But there's also historical periods are major drivers of change, like the Great Depression, or today where we're thinking about 9/11, that create what we call a period rupture, a before and after. And they change how we view the world and how we act within the world, and that can shape a change. And then finally, cohort succession or replacement, or generations, are another mechanism for social change. So people are born into a society as a group, they share common experiences, they engage in similar actions, and then others age out. But as they move through these period ruptures, that they respond to them are very differently. So we tend to use generational labels like millennials or baby boomers or born frees in South Africa, those born after the end of apartheid, to capture this sense that youth have their own distinct, or groups have their own worldview, or entelechies is what we're using here. And so these three drivers of change, aging, historical periods, and cohorts, can create a sociologist called William Ogburn called a cultural lag between a cohort and the times in which it lives. And so what you find within a cohort or generation is some groups who are going to quickly adapt and move with the times, some are going to stick to the old ways, and some are going to try and combine old and new ways in the context of social change. So a final piece to this, I think, is that in this context, HIV is sexually transmitted. And so we want to think both about individual sexuality, both our bodies changing, desire and functioning changing as people age, but also the meaning of sex changing as people age. And then the other piece is that you can't prevent HIV on your own, right? If you're in a partnership, it's an interactive, ongoing process. It's negotiated. And especially for middle-aged and older adults, many transitions such as widowhood, divorce, remarriage, were made worse by the HIV pandemic. And so older adults are having to renegotiate new relationships and things like monogamy, condom use, abstinence, HIV testing, new partnerships. And these are all connected to power and connected to gender norms within a relationship. And then finally, the changing organization and meaning of sexual life in society. So I mentioned the apartheid era system, which separated families and created norms for made extramarital relationships normative. And so here we're calling this a sexual entelechy, or a sexual way, a way of doing sexuality for a particular generation. We can also think about a sexual revolution as another way of thinking about this that changes norms around sexuality. And so let me then talk more specifically about how our respondents acted. And what we found within each generation was a dominant way in which that group acted or responded to the epidemic. And we also found an interesting role of gender and gender power in shaping whether people were able to avoid HIV. And so among the oldest generation, so those who came of age during the apartheid era and before HIV, we found that the epidemic began. They basically ignored HIV, or they circumscribed it, that they said it was just for young people. So for example, for women, Rachel, these are all made up names. Most women over 60 didn't see the need to change, to respond to HIV. Many were widowed or living on their own and said they were no longer interested in sex. And so Rachel, who was left by her husband, said, I didn't look for another man. They said, when you have the desire for sex, you must pray. Then I prayed, and after praying, I felt I don't have that desire. Now, this was several years ago. So now I'm old, I don't care about sex. I'm old and have grandchildren, and there's nothing more to say. She was done. And Fanisa, she used the excuse of her last one child. So after my last child, I stopped. Now I'm abstaining, I don't do it. And these are both women who did not have HIV, but even women who had HIV said the same thing. So Connor said, I don't have affairs, I'm old, HIV affects young ones. And so she didn't appear to know that she was living with HIV. And so overall, older women saying this is for nowadays children, it's not there in our time, it's not our problem, meant that they didn't have to make changes. And so they accepted that their partners were having affairs as normal, and they went to the doctor when they were ill. And so this inadvertently aligned with the prevention campaign saying, you know, you should be abstinent, but also with the church, which was telling them that they should be abstinent. And shouldn't seek partners if they were single. And among men, though, they also experienced aging sexuality, but the way that they expressed it was different. And so David, for example, said, when I was still young, I could do 4 or 5 rounds. Now I do 2 rounds. So hope springs eternal. And he had had many relationships when he was younger, but he said from 94 he stopped having relationships because he said nowadays if you do that, you'll be left with diseases. But what was interesting is when we asked him, has HIV changed how you think about sex? He says, what's changed is I'm getting old. My years are getting up. So suggesting it was less about HIV and more about his changing sexuality. And this came through more in Nelson, who said, I'm becoming weak now. That's why I don't have affairs, right? So it's not because I'm trying to avoid HIV. It's because I'm weak. Alulani was a widower and had relationships after his wife died. And he said, now, you know, you lose all interest after having sex once. And he said, I heard about condoms, but I don't use them. HIV is rare among older adults. And he had HIV. And then finally, for James said, now I only have sex with my wife. I was a playboy when I was young. And then he said, the women who know they're sick, there was one I met, she wanted to have sex with me, but I was saved by God because I've seen that her husband is sick. Her husband told her he's HIV positive. So she's like, gosh, that, you know, thank God I didn't sleep with her when I was younger. And so for men, very few used condoms in this study. For many of them, it was simply that their sexuality aged. So in our study, we call it physiologically engineered fidelity, which seemed to bring them into alignment. It made them monogamous, which aligned with church and also aligned with the HIV campaigns. And now there were a couple of people in our study who did try and avoid HIV, but gender played a big role in this. And so in particular, I'll give the example of Boozy. She was 65, and she was trying to tell her husband was having affairs, and she was trying to tell him to stop. So she told him, nowadays there are lots of illnesses, but he didn't agree with me. The interviewer said, did you use any protection? She said, well, how can you use it if your partner refuses? And so she tested through our survey, went to hospital to pick up her results, and that's how she found out she was positive and she got onto medication. And so she was typical of women of her generation. They could enter, exit relationships freely, but they didn't have power to persuade the husband to stop affairs or to use condoms. And this challenge persisted among women in their 50s. Who were calling it caught between generations because they were the ones who were more likely to try and mix strategies. And so about half tried to, didn't change at all, and about half changed. And so among women, many of them were experiencing aging sexuality. And so I wanted to include a couple quotes on this. So Jane, 55, says, my blood is no longer flowing like when I was young. The blood that was making a person to want a man has stopped. So how are you going to want a man? And she was HIV negative. And Sumi, who's 52, said, he's like, referring to her husband, he's like a chewing gum that has lost taste and sugar. Even if the sugar's finished, you want to keep your mouth busy. You just continue to chew it. Your heart tells you to continue to chew. You also continue. Like, so she didn't want to have sex, but she was just, you know, her heart was telling her to continue to chew. So alongside that, their desire, a reduced desire for sex, most women in their 50s in our study believed their husbands were having affairs, but they didn't do anything. They basically just ignored the risk. Those who had HIV in the study, that they had not been using condoms, and they didn't make any attempt to try and change their husband's behavior, and they hadn't gone for testing. But some women didn't ignore risk, and these women seemed to have the most challenging time. So the ones who didn't pretend it wasn't there, and they had, you know, they were also experiencing aging sexuality, but they were married to men who were having affairs or had affairs in the past. And so the interviews had a lot of worry, fear, and hope of remaining HIV negative. So I want to highlight here the example of Nyeleti, whose interview shows how both her sexuality changed over the course of her life, and also the worry that she lived and the role of faith in helping her manage. So when she was younger, the main rule was postpartum abstinence. So after you have a child, you don't have sex for a period of time. So she said, we're having some rules. If I'm having a baby, we're not having sex. When the baby reaches 1 month, I'm praying that God, please calm down my feelings until we reach the 3 months we agreed on. But then as she got older, she said, you know, now it doesn't bother us much. As a woman, I have to control myself, respect myself. If you want sex, I give it to him. And she says, you know, we're cool now. But then while she was controlling herself, her husband was having extramarital relationships in Johannesburg where he worked. And they had never used condoms and instead relied on faith in the protective power of God. And so she said, I was praying that God must help me, that he becomes tired about them. He was having some girlfriends. But I told myself, I'll never give up. And she went on to say, you know, we're not avoiding or preventing it. We're just protected by Jesus' name and nothing else. Right, and so basically now, though, at the time that we interviewed her, she was basically saying, I'm less worried now because my husband's now old. He can't go for other partners, right? So she's basically waiting for her partner to age out of extramarital relationships. And so now she felt less worried. And so for men, over half of them didn't try to change. And all of them who didn't try to change got HIV. And they described their own partnerships, extramarital partnerships, not using condoms. They only went for testing when they got sick. But some men tried to engage in hybrid responses. So the most interesting one was proxy testing. So they ask their wife to test, and then if the wife is negative, then they assume they're also negative. But others also went for testing every year. And so we were surprised by this because, for example, Matthias was age 51, said, we don't use condoms because I know my wife is clean and I'm clean, but he still went for testing. So we're like, well, why are you testing if you're both? And so he said, I don't go that much there, so I'm not having so many affairs because today's life is difficult. And Henry said, the only thing I did was to reduce outside affairs or partners. Things are not the same now. If I have partners, I won't do anything here at home. I have to give my wife a chance. And so again, it was aging sexuality for him that made him have fewer relationships. So this was a sort of a hybrid approach for men. Now, there were a couple of people who tried to fully adapt. And I want to profile a couple examples here. One was a Mukeleni who was had been educated in the mines about HIV, and so he started using condoms very early. He had relationships, but he used condoms. But at some point he said, you know, I took a resolution, no more affairs, I'm going to church. From that time until now, I never had an affair. I stay with my wife. And so he was helped by participation in the church, which supported monogamy, so the institutional support for his decision to stay with his wife. But for Sarah, the epidemic had forced a reckoning in her 37-year marriage that set her apart from her peers. So her peers were living with worry and hope, but she seemed to have leverage to persuade her husband to practice fidelity or use condoms if they had an extramarital relationship, and she also insisted on regular testing to make sure that he hadn't brought her HIV. And so she said, you must always check because you can tell yourself you're still safe while you have it. And so the leverage of Sarah seemed to be much more reflected in women in the 40s, the last group I'll talk about. In this group were curious. Half of them were highly responsive and extremely responsive to trying to avoid HIV, and the other half seemed to postpone it, many until after they became HIV positive. And so just to give you a flavor of this extreme vigilance, Margaret said, I test four times a year. And then also monitoring her husband, she says, so far my husband is behaving well. And she used to lecture him. In the interview, she said, I keep telling him, do you want to make our kids orphans? So she was really on her husband to make sure he, and if you recall how high the rates are, right, almost 50% of people in their 40s had HIV. So this was a real issue. 50%, yeah, and I can show you the graph again. And Nola, her husband died in a few years before this, and she said, we were always arguing. He started having affairs. I was always shouting at him, he wants to kill us. And so she asked him to go for testing so they could have sex without condoms, and he didn't agree. So she said, well, then I'm not going to have sex with you if you refuse condoms. And so she had the leverage to refuse her husband's sex if he didn't go for testing. And he eventually died. And so now she says, you know, the next relationship I have, you know, we have to use a condom. He has to go for a test. And so this is very different from ignoring or postponing or hybrid strategy. She was just very clear. And the same was true for men who also exhibited this sort of extreme vigilance. So I want to give you one example here of Harman, who was married for 7 years. And asked about why are you using condoms? He says, it's because nowadays we don't trust each other. You have to know you don't trust anything wherever you go. He goes on to say, you know, I'm not with her, my wife. I don't know where she is. She doesn't know where I am. One of us will infect the other. And so he goes on to say, I'm bound to use condoms. Nowadays it's not safe. And so we were struck here that he was saying he's not safe from a wife of 7 years. And so this shows how sort of extreme people who are trying to avoid HIV were, and in a context where the rates were really high. And so what we thought about for people in their 40s, or the reason why they were split in half, was family building. The logic of family building completely contrasted with the logic of HIV prevention, where you're trying to have children, you're trying to have find partners, and using a condom suggested in this setting you don't trust your partner. And so this clash was what led to their postponing acting on HIV until after they got it. So let me just offer some concluding thoughts and then move to Q&A. So overall, we found that among men, especially those over 50, continuities in the sexual economy with labor migration that continued from the apartheid era into the post-apartheid era, recurring reunions and separations, meant that most men limited partnerships not to avoid HIV, but because of a declining capacity to sustain extramarital partnerships and still, quote, give their wife a chance. And there were a few people who were pioneers, men aged over 50, but it was really men in their 40s who were more proactive. So it was the youngest generation who came of age during the era of HIV who really changed. But among women, it seemed to be linked to how much power they had to avoid HIV in their relationship. And so we noticed that each generation had more and more gendered power, leverage to persuade their partners to take up technologies and practices to avoid HIV. So most married women over 50 were basically either doing nothing because they couldn't, or they were circumscribing it as just for young people, or they were crafting hybrid adaptations. They were praying, they were testing, and they were hoping. But it was women in their 40s who were really emboldened to make changes. I think the study also shows how faith can be used in this case to help avoid disease. So praying for abstinence, for example, to be able to be abstinent, as well as when faced with the inability to enact change, praying to not get HIV because they couldn't do anything else. Let me stop there. Just a lot of funding acknowledgements for the National Institute on Aging in particular, and some of the folks who helped me administer the project at Princeton. So I'm going to stop there. I was given half an hour, so I think I'm at time. So I look forward to your comments and questions. Yeah. So questions, comments.
And we're back to being able to pass the mic. So if you have a question, I will run it over to you.
And let me go back and show you that graph again, the HIV prevalence. Cool. Let's see.
Hi, thank you so much, Dr. Majola. I want to know how current your study is. Is this 2013 I'm looking at? So is that how current your study is?
So we did
information that we're hearing today.
So this is when the survey was conducted, and so because people don't, there hasn't been another survey of the whole this particular population done since then. But because people don't get cured from HIV, we know the rates are likely higher. We did interviews in 2013, and then we went back and did interviews in 2018. We were going to go back in 2020, but the fieldwork was obviously canceled, and so we haven't been able to go back.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So we've been following them as they aged. Yeah, so that's the graph, the 50%, you can see people in their late 30s and early 40s. Yeah, okay. Any other questions or,
I wore my sneakers this morning.
Okay, so, you get to the stage when you don't mind asking the dumb questions.
No, those are good. And
I came in late, but you were talking about the sexual revolution after apartheid. It seems to me that the men are having an unusual number of extramarital affairs. Am I just being naive, or is that a real jump, that they're having more extramarital affairs than other places or than that they had before?
Yeah, so part of apartheid played a big role. So what happened during the apartheid era was, first they relocated Africans to poor agricultural land, so they couldn't engage in subsistence farming. So the men had to migrate out to work. They were coerced to work in mines, farms, cities far away. And then they were also denied citizenship, so they needed an official pass to be able to go and visit their families. And they could only go either once a year or every 18 months. And so this created sort of forced families apart. And what started to happen over time was norms around having a partner at work and a partner at home became normal. And so that continued even after apartheid ended, because the economy never improved. In fact, it faltered in the 80s and 90s, and it's still really, really high unemployment. So people still have to go and work far away from home and only come home. So in the case of Nyaleti, her husband was working in Johannesburg. So this was typical. 60% of men in the last estimate were leaving home to work for several. And so the idea that the norms or the idea of having another partner was normal. In this context.
It really sounds like multiple.
So the interesting thing with HIV is it doesn't need multiple. So studies actually find Africans have fewer partners, but they're more likely to be concurrent compared to people in Europe and the US who have more lifetime partners, but serial monogamy, one at a time.
I see.
But in this setting, you tend to have concurrent or overlapping partners. And this is supported by polygamy, so that there's still, still legal to marry more than one wife. Mm-hmm. And so there was already a cultural setup for men having more than one partner. It's just the difference now is that they're less likely to be married partners and more unmarried partners. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, does that answer your question?
Mostly.
You. Well, what part?
Thank you for being here. What drew you to this work?
Yeah. So I'm half Kenyan and half Ugandan. And so across the continent. HIV has devastated the continent. In Uganda in particular was one of the worst, one of the worst epidemics early on. And so my grandma would say she could go to the wrong funeral in a village because there are like five funerals. It was just so bad. Like, it's just really hard to capture how bad it was when every other person is living with it or dying. And then the medicine was like $1,000 per person per month. At the time, it wasn't free. And so the nice thing, actually, it's interesting, with the COVID, how fast, you know, what, a year and a half to get free medication, free vaccines. But for AIDS, there was a lot of activism over many years that had to happen to get it free. In fact, President Bush signed PEPFAR into law, and that, you know, really changed the tide in getting free medication out. But for a long time, it wasn't free. And so this meant that, so I interned with the Anglican Church in Tanzania, had an AIDS control agency. And so after college, I interned with her for a counselor for 6 months. So what would happen is, you know, people, and mostly women, would come in for counseling before and after the test. And so before the test, it would be like, okay, what are you going to do if you're positive? You know, who will take care of your children? Because it's a death sentence, right? Who will take care of your children? Where are you going to live? Like, you know, and I was so struck by the fact that millions of women, and, you know, were going to go through this. So about 60% of the cases in Africa, women, more women have HIV compared to men. And so I realized that this is a problem of millions. And so who's working on this? And they all had PhDs, and they were all in Europe and the US. So I'm like, I need to get a PhD. So that's what took me to grad school, was I just wanted to figure out what are large-scale policies, structural solutions to bring an end to the AIDS epidemic. So that's kind of what drew me into it, was just, there's just so much death. I think the first project, the final thing I'll say, the first project I worked on was an area 30 minutes from where my grandma lived, at where I had cousins. And in that area, I read a study showing about 30% of young women had HIV, age 15 to 19, and almost 40% of 20 to 24-year-olds. And I didn't believe the statistics. So I dug in and realized, no, actually, this is a good study. This is poorly accurate. And that's what took me to actually start interviewing people and not just doing survey analysis. Like, what's going on? How can so much death be happening? Yeah.
Many people in the United States are concerned about the price of prescription drugs. Could you comment on the affordability of the medications that are available?
Yeah. Great question. Thankfully now it's free. HIV medication is free. But the problem is getting to the clinic. So especially among our oldest respondents who are living on fixed incomes, the challenge is finding money for transport to get to the clinic in order to get the free medication. So there are other kinds of barriers. The other is free medication, but for HIV medication, you need a steady diet. You have to have good food to manage the medication, and some cannot afford the food. So it's really ironic. The medicine is now free, but all the things to get the medicine and to manage, live with the medicine, are the challenges. But this was the activism that happened to make it available for free. Yeah. And South Africans are much better off, and they have a much larger program than many countries. But thank God it's now. Yeah.
So you just mentioned in your experience that you worked for an organization through the Anglican Church that had HIV prevention. I'm curious to hear a little bit more. Like, some of your respondents talked about, I started going to church. Yeah. And so they said not to do this. So I'm curious about the role of churches in this.
It's complicated. It's really complicated. The church has been both the best and worst of the AIDS response. Like, a lot of the stigma, you know, this was a personal challenge as well, right? I grew up in an Anglican church and a Christian household, you know, and then this is all sin. This is like ugly sin. People should not be having affairs, should not be having sex outside of marriage. Like, this is this, you know, but I felt really drawn to studying this, and I was really convicted in graduate school that this is about the love of God. God loves everybody. Your job is not to judge or condemn. These are the least of these. Go talk to them. Go listen. Don't judge. But the church has judged a lot, like a lot, for the obvious reason, because it is sin, right? But is it the church's place to lead with judgment or to lead with love? So it was really when the widows and orphans started showing up, they're like, oh my goodness, oh, we need to care. And then the pastors themselves started getting HIV. Oh, all have sinned. we all need to do something about this. And so you know, the church has been then extraordinarily compassionate in providing care, and, because it's many churches are community organizations, because eventually it had to. In Uganda, the Catholic Church was handing out condoms. I mean, that's how bad it got. Like, forget the Pope. We have to save, you know, who's coming? Nobody's coming to church. They're dying or taking care of dying relatives, right? So at some point, reality hits and people, everyone comes off the pedestal and just gets involved, because everybody, you know, is you're infected or affected, was the saying. Since then, though, again, as you can see, that it's less about are you religious or are you not religious, but how are you making use of religion? And so in the case of women, it seemed as if, well, there's nothing else I can do, so I'm going to pray. But when you could do something, you know, interviewees were not saying, oh, I'm praying to protect. They were insisting the husbands should not have affairs, but if they had leverage. But if they didn't, that's when they seemed to be turning to prayer. So, yeah, so it's really complicated to navigate.
Friends, can we give another round of applause for Dr. Majola?
Thank you.
Thank you so much for kicking off our Hearing from All Corners of Our Community series. And I hope that you all will come back next week when we will be hosting Dr. Lisa Bowens from Princeton Theological Seminary. We'll be talking about Reception, Resistance, and Transformation, African American Readings of Paul. Thank you all so much. Have a great day.
Thanks.